Hi, this is Juliet Landau, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
I need you to be a mess.
We need you to be a mess.
You have to be weak.
Be weak. Be an hog.
I'm making a vampire documentary.
Crime section, this may be rough.
The only thing I know for sure is that he is a detailed and meticulous psychopath.
You have this way of taking things to the edge.
It's important not to get too close to the flame.
Leave it alone. I mean, you're like a dog with a bone with this thing. Just cut and I'll talk to you.
He's baiting you. Leading you into his world.
For a suspect GOA.
Help! Help me!
Hello and welcome to GeekCast Radio Presents. This is an interview series that we here at GeekCast Radio Network are doing over various shows that we produce. It'll also be syndicated on Altered Geek and Studio 2009, two of our shows that we produce. I am your host for this evening, TFG1 Mike. Coming to the studios tonight is Juliet Landau. Miss Landau is an actress, director, producer, and writer. As an actress, highlights include her role as Drusilla on Joss Whedon's Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the spin-off Angel, co-starring in Tim Burton's Ed Wood as Loretta King. She played the recurring role of Rita Tedesco on Amazon's number one series, Bosch, in 2014. She played that in season 5 of that show. She is recurring as Cordelia. Hey, wait a second. Yep, different show, different character. On TNT's Claws, Juliet just helmed her visionary feature film directorial debut, A Place Among the Dead, which I have just recently seen, and wow. We welcome Miss Juliet Landau to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm really happy to be here. How are you doing today?
I am doing wonderfully. And I have seen your directorial debut, A Place Among the Dead. And it's very interesting, and I will get to that. I have several questions down the line here. But first, did you always want to be an actress? Did you always want to be in acting?
You know, I was a ballerina to begin with. So I have a dance background. Then I started taking acting classes and really loved the verbal communication, getting to use physicality as one aspect of a character, but also getting to use dialogue and have a discussions about conceptual ideas and all of that stuff. And so then I got bitten by the acting bug.
Awesome, yeah. Okay, you've played a numerous amounts of characters on your career. Looking at your filmography, it's like you've played all kinds of characters. Like, I know I've played up the whole Drusilla thing because that's mainly where I know you from. And I, well, like I said to you off air, I'm like, my buddy Steve told me, and I was like, do you not know who that is? And he's like, I'm like, dude, that's, yeah, we need that interview, because, wow, it'd be such a pleasure to talk to her.
Aw, yay.
What are some of your favorites out of your characters that you've played over your career?
Gosh, well, I would say right now, Jules, which is the character that I play in my directorial feature debut, A Place Among the Dead, and it's right now in its first window of distribution. Also, Loretta King from Ed Wood, Drusilla, of course, on Buffy and on Angel, And then I think I'd have to mention a couple theater roles. I loved playing Roberta in Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, which is a beautiful John Patrick Shanley play, and Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire, which is one of the best roles ever written.
Which characters are the most challenging for you?
You know, every character has its challenges, but that's really what's fun about what I get to do. Each role is sort of its own puzzle, its own recipe of ingredients, and so I don't know. There's always a moment with a character where it sort of all starts to coalesce and come together. I think, you know, you mentioned Rita Tedesco on Bosch, and it wasn't a challenging character, but one of the things that was interesting is that I think when I started, it was hard for me to not be at arm's length and sort of have some preconceived judgments about the character. She was a character who was married to a man on death row. But as I started to do research about the real women that are involved with these men, and it's quite a phenomenon. There's actually, believe it or not, there's dating sites for men on death row. There's all kinds of things that I didn't know about prior to getting this part. But what was sort of interesting is finding that at the end of the day, it was almost like a long-distance relationship, a traditional long-distance relationship, mm-hmm. except that instead of it being across, you know, countries or states or locations in that way, it was inside of prison and outside of prison. And I started to realize how most of us could relate to having had at least one relationship where we sort of fell in love or like with the idea of who the person was rather than the reality of who they truly were or are. And so so it was interesting to start to crawl into that skin and sort of see the elements of it that are very human and that we all can relate to.
Mm. Yeah, that's it's always kind of crazy when you have a picture of somebody in your head, and when you see the reality, it's like they're nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was funny because I actually, for Rita, one of the things I asked was we had the second in command of South Central Homicide for 25 years consulted on my film A Place Among the Dead, and so when I was doing I knew Sal from before, and so when I was doing Bosch, I called him and said, "Well, what do you think about, you know, you've come into contact with a lot of these wives and girlfriends and stuff?" And he said, "Juliet, you know, I hang out with these. I put them behind bars. I don't really hang out with them once they're there." So it made me laugh. I was like, "Okay, I just thought you might have a take that would be interesting." He said, "Look, I can consult on the police side of it, but I can't really talk to you about that side too much."
Yeah. Okay, so I kind of think I know what the answer is going to be to this one, because it's kind of all of them are, because it's just, how could they not be? But I know sometimes are not so. Which characters were the most fulfilling for you to play?
Ooh, gosh. Well, I mean, all of the ones I previously mentioned, I would have to say, were incredibly fulfilling. But there is nothing like the theater and doing the run of a play. So I would have to say Roberta and Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, because it was, you know, we were originally going to do a 6-week run, and we ended up doing a 6-month run in Los Angeles, which is not a theater town.
Because, no, it's not.
Yeah. So it was incredible because of the rave reviews and audience response and repeat business and all of that stuff. We ran for 6 months straight. Every night we were more than sold out, like way past capacity, had to add seats. So that was a tremendous experience. And also Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire, just because it's so profound in the way that all of the dynamics of the character. So I would have to mention a couple of the the theater roles just because you get to live with them over such a period of time, and they get to grow. Much like when you're doing either a series, regular or recurring role, you get that experience. Obviously, I got an experience to live for a long time with Drusilla, and that was really, really something too.
Yep, absolutely. You mentioned Drusilla. This is the only question I'll ask about her. What was your favorite part about playing that role? Because it seems to me, just as a viewer of that series and of those two series and that character, it seems like you had a lot of fun doing that.
I did. She was a delicious character. And I think what I responded to most was, well, first of all, the writing. Joss is a brilliant and visionary writer and creator. And I, the character of Dru was multidimensional. Many times you get villains and they're one or two dimensions. And she really had so many different sides to her. She had this epic love affair as well as being a diabolical character. She was very childlike but sensual. She was, clearly not the most stable mentally of all people or all vampires included. So I think it was the fact that there were so many colors to her, and that was, that makes it really fun for an actor.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get to A Place Among the Dead, again, when Steve told me Juliet Landau, and I'm like, hey, that's Tala from Justice. I'm like, oh, yes. Goody, yay. What is it that you enjoy about the voice acting side of acting the most?
Well, I love Tala. Tala's definitely one of my favorite voice acting roles. And also, there was a character named La Bella that I did in a Green Lantern movie. Mm-hmm. The thing that I enjoy the most, I would say, is that it really even further expands your range. And for the character of La Bella, I would never have been cast in real life in terms of physically for the character. So you get to play roles that you wouldn't necessarily be able to because of the limitations of your age or your type or all of those things that you can transcend with when it's just your voice, and you can play with modulating it, and you can play with accents, and you can play with all of that kind of stuff. So I think that's my favorite part about it. And I think my second favorite part is that you don't have to go through any of the primping part, and you can basically practically be in your jammies, and you don't have to have your hair done, and often you're either sometimes you're recording alone in a booth, but often you get to work in a semicircle with a group of actors and play off of one another in the moment, and that's really like a dance, and it's just so much fun.
Yeah, that ensemble. I remember a number of years ago now, we had got to interview Jason Marsden, and I had mentioned to him about the same thing that you're talking about the voice acting, and you don't have to, put on a suit and tie or anything like that. And I'm like, really? Really, Jason? Prove it. The day after we recorded that interview, he tweeted me a picture of him in his pajamas at a session for Thundercats back in 2011. Right. It was hilarious.
Funny though, I think I know I voiced Lois Lane in a project, and I think that may have been the one I went. And I somehow the publicist there didn't tell me that they were going to be doing the EPK of the that would be filmed on camera while we were doing it. And I actually generally go to voice recordings, somewhat dressed and stuff. And for whatever reason, with scheduling that time, I came straight from the gym. I was sweaty, no makeup, my hair was a mess. I walk in and they were like, oh, did you not get the memo? I'm like, what memo? Oh, we're shooting on camera today. I was like, no,
oh,
are you kidding?
No.
And so it was crazy. And they were like, we can reschedule your bit. I'm like, I think that might be a good idea. And I'm wearing like this sweaty tank top. I don't know if that's like the sort of Lois Lane persona that will be the best. So
yeah.
So that was funny because it was the one time that I actually showed up assuming I wouldn't be seen, and but it ended up working out anyway. Worse things have happened.
Yeah. I think that was Justice League Throne of Atlantis. I think that's
it was.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Oh my God, I'm impressed. Well, I also love the other character that voiceover-wise that I love is the little sisters in BioShock. That's a particularly fun recording session, and the character was, you know, was incredible in how she fit into the game.
Mm. Very cool, very cool. All right, now the thing that everyone's here for, A Place Among the Dead, your new film. How did this come about? How did you go about writing it with Dev and uh-huh. the whole thing? What was the genesis of this?
The movie explores the repercussions of growing up under the sway of narcissism and evil. My husband, Deverell Weeks, Dev, who you're talking about, he co-wrote and co-produced the movie with me, and we both come from this background. We wanted to make a movie that we hadn't seen before, talk about something that isn't covered in films and really isn't talked about in society as a whole, but there is a yearning for it. If you type in narcissism for a search, the numbers are staggering. YouTube has 9,120,000 videos on the subject. Google has 70,400,000 results. And when you type in psychological abuse, it has 188 million Google results. Of course, we're getting at this through art and entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And how was this, with it being your directorial debut, how was it being on that side of things? Because most of the projects you've worked on, at least to my knowledge, you can always correct me, mm-hmm. you've been the actress. You've been the person playing a part that someone has written for you. So with you and your husband writing this and crafting this and you directing everything to go along with it, how was that process for you? How did that work in your brain and all that?
You know, I had directed two shorts before, but this was the first time directing a scripted narrative feature and being in it as well as directing it, which means that you're switching between subjective and objective constantly while on set, at least. The thing that's interesting in terms of this movie is it is crafted in a way that it's entirely scripted, but we wanted to blur the lines of reality. So there's part factual stuff in there. There's mm-hmm. it's part fiction and part fantastical. And I play an alter ego version of myself, as does Gary Oldman, Ron Perlman, Robert Patrick, Lance Henriksen, Joss Whedon, and best-selling authors Charlaine Harris and Anne Rice appearing for the first time ever in a scripted movie. And even the interview sections in the movie, they're all faux interviews. They're all completely scripted to seem spontaneous. And so it was definitely, I'll put it this way, it's definitely a bigger workload. It's funny, I just was shooting a movie again as solely an actress, and even though, you know, and it was a very COVID protocol safe set, the director uncle passed away from COVID, so he was particularly it was really buttoned down. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was funny is even when you're shooting, you know, really long hours on film sets, you often go 16-17 hour days. It actually felt like a vacation compared to when you're wearing so many hats, because you know you're one component of the whole. You're not making every creative choice. As the director and producer, you're there first. You're leaving last. You're busy when looking at footage after the workday. You're working, prepping for the next workday. You know, it's basically a 24/7 gig. So it was funny because I was like, oh, the few jobs I've been back recurring on Claws and all of that stuff, and it actually feels like really being, you know, essentially like I'm in Hawaii or something, because it's so much less work, you know, even though there's work, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. So with the COVID precautions and protocols and all that and everything else, how do you feel that has changed? I'm sorry, I didn't send this to you before.
Okay.
How do you feel that has changed Hollywood? How do you feel that, you know, obviously it's for the best. Hello, everybody needs to stay healthy.
Yes.
But, like, as the creative part of it or whatever, how much of a hindrance is, like, what's the difference between before and now?
Well, I agree with you. First and foremost, everybody needs to stay healthy, and we all need to take care of one another. The thing that's been interesting for us work-wise at this juncture is that we've been doing something which is, you know, we made this movie for a number of reasons. First of all, to make an entertaining film, but also to give voice to what has affected many, to invite the audience member to become the participant, to open up a dialogue about this subject, which is needed right now. We're in a time where there's an escalation of narcissism, cruelty, evil actions, bad behavior. So one of the things that's been interesting in this time period is that we have been doing something that has been very much in line with the vision of why we wanted to make the film and in having the this kind of conversation. And so what's happened is our distributor is Modern Films, and they do screening events. And mm-hmm. so we started thinking about, why don't we talk to New York Comic Con? And we ended up being sponsored by New York Comic Con and MAC Cosmetics. And one of the things that was incredible is that I've been to Comic Cons and I've done a lot of panels, and the whole structure of that is that it generates later ticket sales. Mm-hmm. But this made the film available right there. There's a hub virtually where everyone from all over the world, and we've been having that our screening events, streams the movie, watches it together, has a Q&A, and then we interact about it right then. And it is a brand new way to reach the audience. And with the closures of cinema everywhere, as well as the general direction that movies were going in before COVID, this will be some aspect of the future. It's the water cooler / cinema experience, which has been lacking culturally, where everything's been so spread out and dispersed. People watch stuff at their, you know, on streaming, but there's no sort of coming together to talk about it, other than people separately doing blogs and stuff. And so it's been kind of incredible to get to actually be in the moment when people are watching it together and then having these discussions on a global level. And so that's something that wouldn't have happened pre-COVID, and in thinking about how to do it. And what's been extraordinary is every single interactive Zoom with the audience, the entire audience has stayed, and these Zooms are lasting 4 hours every time. It's been just so profound and so powerful.
Yeah. And the movie itself, I mean, when I was watching it, I was like, this melds, like you already said, so many things. It's, since about, I would say, 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. I've been a true crime fan.
Oh,
I've been, you know, watching Investigation Discovery, or I've seen every single Forensic Files episode multiple times, where I can hear the first sentence out of Peter Thomas's mouth, may the man rest in peace. I can hear the first sentence out of his mouth and know what episode it is, and I'm like, okay, no, I can't deal with that episode right now, kind of thing. But your movie melds that kind of thing in with an actual fictitious universe, and I think that is so interesting.
Thank you. You know, we chose to use the you know, genre for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's an entertaining genre. If you type in vampires, there are 278 million Google results. And same with when you look at true crime, like the numbers of results are astounding. And so we wanted to really, and in our film, you're never quite sure, there's a character, you're never quite sure, is he a vampire or is he a serial killer who's emulating a vampire in the way that he murders, like you're talking about in terms of the true crime. you know, we wanted to lull the audience into a sense of safety to explore unsafe and radical ideas. It was a way also to bring in my history and my connection to Buffy and Angel, and also the other characters and actors' histories. Mm-hmm. And the vampire felt like the perfect metaphor for the ultimate narcissist. And whether he's a serial killer or whether he's a vampire, the traits are the same.
Right.
And so that was, you know, what we're really sort of why we're using this particular thing, and that's one of why we married it in the way that it's constructed.
I mean, I honestly think the if you think of all the Universal movie monsters, the vampire is probably the only one you could, you know, really accurately say that it could also be a serial killer kind of thing. Because I mean, the Mummy, you just unwrap it. Frankenstein, you put his brain back in his head.
Right.
The Wolfman, you just shave him, he's fine.
Right.
Now I know that you're talking about the Zoom audience watches and things like that. I'm going to actually have this up December 11th. You've got an event coming up Saturday, December 12th, correct?
Yes, we are doing it along with Wales Comic Con, and it's another interactive event, and we will be streaming the movie, doing the Q&A, and having the interactive Zoom. And so, yeah, that's amazing. I'm excited that you're going to be posting before our next event.
Yep. So hopefully everyone can listen to this, and then you can go check that out. All the links will be in the show notes for the interview post.
One of the things that's been so fascinating in the conversations is how much the film is resonating and how many people have started the conversation with things like, I've never told anybody this before, but, and this particular part or this dialogue made me think about that, which is exactly what I was saying about wanting the viewer to become the participant in the movie. Is that's what we're really looking at, is that self-reflection. And whether it's in the case that of the movie, it's familial narcissism, but mm-hmm. Whether it's an ex-boyfriend, a wife, a family member, a boss, a coworker, a friend, or our world leaders, one of the things that keeps emerging in all of these talkbacks is how people start saying, it feels like we're talking about one person, no matter what. Like, these traits are so much the same that I feel like you're talking about my ex-husband, or I feel like you're talking about my girlfriend, or I feel... And that's been one of the things that has been emerging from these discussions.
Well, yeah, because everybody, you're approaching a topic that everyone has some sort of, it's sad to say, but some sort of experience with.
Yes.
I don't think there's anybody on our entire planet...
Nope.
Has not experienced some form of evil, as sad as that is to say, but it's out there, and while it does suck, mm-hmm. you know, we all have the first thing I thought of as I was watching it was, I know I am so self-deprecating to the point of my depression just uh-huh. going even further than it already does.
Right.
Because I always say, oh, I'm the worst, or I'm this, or I'm...
Right.
You know, in the last couple of... because this is... you are my first... Well, not my first, but the first interview I'm actually producing by myself in over a year, because my computer had been in storage for the last year.
Right.
So, it's like... Oh God, I don't want to screw this up. I don't want to screw this up. Oh my God, I am the one. And a few of the episodes that I've been recording in the last mm-hmm. couple of weeks, I'm like, at some point in the episode, it's like, it's okay. I'll fix it in the editing. I'm the worst podcaster ever anyway, so it's not like anyone's going to listen to this. But people should listen to this one.
But you know that it's so. What you're sharing is exactly what we've been talking about. I mean, Dev and I talked about the fact that we had never seen a film where the voiceover sounded remotely like the thoughts running through our minds. And you know, we did some studies on this, and even for people that come from the most healthy, loving, stable backgrounds, it turns out that 80% of the thoughts in all of our minds, those voices running those tapes, are negative. That's a huge amount of derisive inner monologue going on. And so what we really wanted to look at is, especially if you come from this kind of background, you're not your authentic self, and you let those negative thoughts and voices run you and lead you to destructive choices. You know, the whole point of the movie is that there is a different way. As an adult, you can make different choices. You can break those agreements, because we all make agreements, especially in our formative years and you know, with our families. We make those agreements, and then you operate out of those agreements to a point. But as adults, we can say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, obviously, in the movie, my alter ego is not doing that. She's letting the unconscious run the show. She's letting those voices lead her. Hopefully I'm not doing that in life anymore, but I did for a long time. And so what you're sharing about the thoughts, I mean, that's one of the things that people are responding to so strongly is, you know, we sort of pretend that those thoughts don't exist, you know, and what's been, people are, I think, liberated to say, oh my God, I'm terrible and I've screwed this up and I'm drive myself in this way that, you know, isn't necessary. Imagine if we spent, you know, even 20% less than that, like we had 20% more energy instead of having those negative thoughts to what could be positive contributing to the world. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You know, and it's so interesting what you're talking about because you know, in distilling, like, where do those thoughts come from and how many of those are actually legitimately my thoughts, or how am I running that from something else that, you know, I was either told or that I made this agreement on. And it's sort of interesting to step back and look at that and say, And one of the things that was interesting in scripting it is Dev and I sort of pooled. Our backgrounds are so similar, not socioeconomically, not location-wise, but in every other way. And that's the thing that we're finding is that it crosses all boundaries. It crosses all, you know, parts of the world, all of that stuff. But what was interesting in doing that and recording that, this stuff, is thinking at first like, wow, you know, it's sort of particularly revealing these ugly thoughts. And oh, you know, people are going to think whatever they're going to think about. And the thing that everybody's been saying is like, oh, I have those all the time. Those are my thoughts. Like, I felt like you were recording a lot of my thoughts.
Yeah, the narration really does drive the film, as well as obviously the rest of the pieces that drive the film. But the narration, I feel, is a big part of it, especially when you get towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily want to spoil it for people, but I'm going to say there is a scene where your character is in a room by herself, and there are times where, like, for me, like, I try my best every day to wake up and do the best I can, but if just one little thing, all it takes is one little crack, and it just ruins the rest of my day. There have been times where I'm like, I just want to be in a padded room and just scream for hours on end. That's all I need. I just need to let it. And there have been times, last year or whatever, when when Karen and my wife and I were out, we were living in Illinois at the time. I slipped and fell on the ice. I just laid there and screamed for 20 minutes because I couldn't move.
Oh, gosh.
You know, so it's like all of these emotions, all of these feelings. Yes, we want to project the best self we can. However, all it takes is one bad day, and it just it's just one of those things where a switch flips, and you're like, "Well, this day is sunk." Even though you may try to get it to be still a good day after that sinking moment.
Right.
So sometimes you just need to go to bed and just let that day go. Say, okay, that's that day. Let's, you know, continue on to the next one.
Well, it's interesting too what you're talking about, because how many of us have had moments in a room alone where mm-hmm. you're having an excess or a whatever of emotion, that you end up in a room on your own when you've had that mm-hmm. bad day, when you've had that bad thing, that thing yeah. that sort of set you off into the wrong direction or feeling like that. You know, it's another thing that's been so interesting is I had a woman write me a letter who is a BAFTA nominated, hugely successful producer, and mm-hmm. I didn't know her prior. She saw the film and she said, I've never told anybody but this before, but this was, this was my mother, and I spent my life basically, and she's had all these amazing deals. She's put together like all this incredible stuff. And she said, every day I would wake up, it's sort of what you were describing. I'd wake up and it was like crossing this abyss to feel like I deserved to actually mm-hmm. do this. And some people have an easier go of it, some people don't, but for me, every single day, and now it's gotten easier, and it's so amazing that you're right, directed this movie, and that this movie is having the kind of response it is and the discussions that it's having, because if I had seen a movie like this when I was younger, I maybe would have had this discussion way before, like, you're the first person I've mm-hmm. talked to about it. And, obviously, it's great to know you're not the only person that and I would have never known about her from looking at her life on the outside that right. she would say every morning it was like crossing an abyss, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because we don't always, even though it has its toxicities, it's given a voice to everybody. Mm-hmm. But most of the time on social media, most people are trying to not be their real selves.
Right, right.
It's just a defense mechanism. They're put, it's like, you have to fake it to make it. Well, that's not always true, but sometimes most people do that just because they feel as if it's going to be too vulnerable to share uh-huh. what they're really feeling, or it's going to be too, I don't want to say, what am I looking for here? It's going to be too controversial, or it's going to make their family and friends look at them in a different light. It's like uh-huh. I don't know, it just feels like you need to be able to have that outlet, and I think A Place Among the Dead is going to give people, like you've already said in this uh-huh. interview, that it has given people, but once more people see it, it's going to show people that you can talk about these things and uh-huh. it's okay to share these feelings with whomever you need to share them with, whether it's a stranger, whether it's your family, whether it's your friends, uh-huh. spouse, children, whatever.
Uh-huh.
It's, yeah. This is something that and a lot of people say this, it's not just me, but, it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah, it is, and it's okay to have, and obviously, you pick and choose, like, who you want to, share stuff with and all of that, mm-hmm. but you are talking about something where also there's been a stress sort of on the superficial, right? Mm-hmm. And what sort of materialism and what people have and how people look, and and it's nice to look nice, it's nice to have things that you like, but really if that's it and that's the level of what's sort of out there, again, we're dealing with something when you're talking about superficiality that links back to narcissism, right? Like mm-hmm. you're not going deeper and not having like a true human connection about all the other parts of ourselves that we can connect on and that we can share on and that we can try to make, the short time that we have on the planet, an experience where we, contribute and connect and communicate and do all these things that hopefully help one another.
Yeah, absolutely. So, A Place Among the Dead, you've got the premiere tomorrow, December 12th, 2020. Can you give us the details on that, please?
Well, yeah, we actually have done the premiere already, but we're doing this series. That's okay. We're doing these series of screening events, and they are interactive, and they are amazing, as we've been talking about. And the best way for people to check it out is to go to Modern Films, which is our distributor, so modernfilms.com/A Place Among the Dead. We're also playing right now at Lemley Virtual Theaters in the U.S., and we will be, you know, worldwide POVD window will be coming soon, but we're going to be continuing doing these interactive events for a while as well, and so the tickets and the info is all available at that link.
Awesome. Anything else you want to say about the film before I close it out, Juliet?
I don't think so, unless there's anything else you wanted to sort of ask me. I mean, this was a really incredible conversation.
It was. I know this will probably never happen, considering what happens to them, but how would you approach Drusilla if she ever came back?
Ooh, I don't know. It would be interesting to see what the storyline would be. It would be so great. I got to co-write 2 issues of the comic book, the IDW comic book about Drew. It'd be really cool to see if Drew ever got to have either like a soul or a redemption story, like what she would do with sort of all of the damage that she had created. It'd be kind of interesting to see what that storyline might afford. I don't know. I think they're that maybe.
Absolutely. All right. I would like to thank Ms. Juliet Landau for taking the time to chat with me here in this Geekcast Radio Presents interview. You can visit our website, and it'll have links to the Modern Films website and everything else where you can connect with all of that for A Place Among the Dead. Until next time, unleash the geek in you, and I will see you soon, folks.
Hi there. This is Juliet Landau, and you are listening to the Geekcast Radio Network. A place.